Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, January 30th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn-Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 12 of the ceasefire after 471 days of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, we'll speak with Abid Ayyub, Executive Director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the ADC, to talk to us about the U.S. government's escalating attack on those who speak up for Palestinian rights and what we can do to protect ourselves individually and collectively. And later on in the program, John will cover the prisoner exchange in Gaza City, the newly released videos of Beit Hanun operations before the ceasefire, and new footage showing Yahya Sinwar on the front lines. But first, here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and Lebanon. As we discussed on Tuesday's special live stream broadcast, Palestinians who have spent the last 15 months displaced from their homes and communities in Gaza have begun to return. On Wednesday, the Gaza government media office stated that more than 500,000 forcibly displaced persons have returned to the northern governorates since the withdrawal on Monday of Israeli occupation forces from the Netzarim corridor, which split Gaza in half. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud, reporting from Gaza City on Wednesday, said that, quote, "Everything has been destroyed, from the public facilities to the residential buildings. There's nothing left. There are areas we spent over half an hour driving by where all we saw was sheer destruction," he added. "Entire residential neighborhoods have been wiped off the map. In some areas, there are no signs of destroyed homes at all, as everything was completely bulldozed. Not even the rubble exists anymore. We also saw some families returning to homes that are damaged. They stood in front of the homes for hours, wondering where and how to start. The joy of returning to northern Gaza has faded away in the face of the massive heartbreak and disappointment." The video we are showing was taken by our contributor, Abu Bakr Abed. As people return to their homes, or what is left of their homes, in northern Gaza, civil defense and paramedic crews say they continue to retrieve the decomposed remains of Palestinians in multiple locations along the coastal road that had been occupied and closed by Israeli forces. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said that it had recovered at least 14 bodies on the road, and the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 59 bodies of people killed in previous Israeli attacks have been recovered from the rubble on Wednesday alone. More than 400 bodies have been retrieved since the January 19th ceasefire. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have continued to attack Palestinians in Gaza. The Palestine Red Crescent reported on Wednesday that Israeli snipers shot at one of the ambulances while it was, quote, "carrying out an urgent mission in the Tel Sultan area west of Rafah in the south." The United Nations stated that on Monday, January 27th, a girl was killed and others injured when an animal-driven cart was hit on Al-Rashid Road, northwest of An-Nusayrat, while returning towards the north. On the same day, the UN says a man was reportedly killed and others injured when a bulldozer was hit in Al-Nuairi area, northwest of Nusayrat. Abu Bakr Abed, reporting for Dropsite News, writes that more than 80 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire began, including 49 in Rafah alone. Dr. Zahar Al-Wahidi, the Palestinian Health Ministry's information director, told Abu Bakr and Dropsite News that, quote, "We need caterpillars and bulldozers to clear up the wreckage and recover these corpses. People are getting back to literally nothing. Rafah is destroyed and the killing and bombing continue there. Nearly 700 bodies are still trapped under the rubble in Rafah. Retrieving them mainly depends on allowing this essential machinery that can help with this cumbersome mission." The Gaza government media office reported on January 28th that civil security crews have worked to neutralize dangerous remnants of Israeli weaponry across the Gaza Strip. Quote, "Specialized teams have made strenuous efforts over the past days to remove unexploded ordnance and missiles and secure residential areas, which contributed to reducing potential risks to the lives of civilians, especially children who are exposed to these remnants while playing in the affected areas, the media office stated. The steady flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the work of local mutual aid organizations are providing life-saving supplies for Palestinians starved and sickened by Israel's genocidal siege. 14 Turkish aid ships carrying more than 870 tons of supplies, power generators, portable toilets, and thousands of tents and blankets arrived at the Arish port in Egypt on Wednesday. The Egyptian government said that the Rafah border crossing is set to reopen within days and that the Egyptian side of the crossing is ready for operation. North Sinai Governor Khaled Mojawer told the Anadolu news agency that, quote, the problem lies with the Palestinian side due to the damage caused by the Israeli military operations. The Palestinian side of the Rafah crossing has been forcibly closed and destroyed by Israel since early May. The World Food Program stated that it brought more food to people in Gaza during the first 4 days of the ceasefire than what it could previously dispatch on average per month. The UN reports that on Tuesday, January 28th, 13 of its supported bakeries began operating at full capacity, 8 in Deir Ebalah and 5 in Khan Yunus. These include 8 bakeries that had previously closed due to flour shortages and 5 new ones, the UN added. The Samir Project, a local mutual aid organization, said their volunteers distributed 51,000 liters of fresh water in Jabalia and Gaza City on Wednesday and provided free transportation to around 500 people returning from the south to the north. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, said that it had significantly scaled up its humanitarian operations in Gaza since the ceasefire began, including delivering more than 500,000 food parcels in just 9 days. The agency said on Wednesday that nearly 370 pallets of essential medications, including insulin syringes sufficient for over 17,000 people suffering from diabetes for 8 months, as well as laboratory and dental supplies, have also been dispatched to UNRWA-run health facilities, including in Deir Ebalah, Nusayrat, Al-Mawasi, and the Beach Health Center in Gaza Governorate, where services have been restored this week. More than 1,000 UNRWA healthcare providers have held appointments with nearly 14,000 patients and have supported solid waste collection efforts in 4 Gaza municipalities. UNRWA has also distributed hygiene items, potable and domestic water and shelter supplies, such as tarpaulins and blankets, to hundreds of families across Gaza, while about 22,000 tents are in the pipeline ready to enter the strip. However, the Israeli Knesset activated legislation it passed last month to order the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, to cease operations as of today. Philippe Lazzarini, UNRWA's Commissioner General, spoke to the UN Security Council on Tuesday, saying that, quote, full implementation of the Knesset legislation will be disastrous. In Gaza, undermining UNRWA's operations will compromise the international humanitarian response. It will degrade the capacity of the United Nations just when humanitarian assistance must be scaled up significantly. This will only worsen the already catastrophic living conditions of millions of Palestinians. As of this broadcast, UNRWA says that it has not received any official communication on how the Israeli parliament's bills banning UNRWA will be implemented. We'll have more on Israel's attempts to undermine the agency in the coming weeks. The spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, Asim Al-Nabi, who is also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada, reported that municipal engineers and workers have been assessing the damage to the city's water networks and planning the repairs as people return to the north. The water supply is only reaching 40% of the city's total area, Al-Nabi stated, and the amount of water available to residents is extremely limited and falls far short of meeting their basic needs. Water networks have suffered severe damage, he added, and 75% of the central water wells have been damaged during the war. However, the delivery of fuel, which Israel had heavily restricted during the last 15 months, is helping to operate some of the sewage systems and water sources. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, says that its delivery of 10,000 liters of fuel has enabled the Palestinian Water Authority to resume operation of sewage pumps and water wells in North Gaza for the first time in 3 months. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of this one by Rasha Abu Jalal, writing from Gaza. Rasha profiles three Palestinians who are returning or preparing to return to their homes in the north or in the south after more than a year of forced displacement. She writes, quote, "On the roof of a cart piled high with children and luggage, Isam Abu Maher, 39, stared at the long road ahead of him. Abu Maher was heading back to see his hometown of Huza, east of Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip, from where he had been forced to leave, along with all Huza's residents, in December 2023. Everyone on board the vehicle on January 20th seemed happy that their displacement was over and the road to Huza was crowded. But as soon as Abu Maher's vehicle arrived in the town, joy turned into shock. The devastation was beyond imagination. Streets had been bulldozed, homes had been completely destroyed, and piles of rubble were everywhere. Abu Maher stood in the middle of the rubble that was once his home, picking up a handful of dirt between his fingers as if trying to restore the memory of the place. I thought we were returning to our homes, but we returned to a graveyard of stones. No walls or doors, just rubble and the memories buried beneath it," Abu Maher told the Electronic Intifada. Still determined to stay in their hometown, Abu Maher, like other residents of the town, pitched his tent in front of the ruins of his old home. "If I am destined to live in a tent, let it be on top of the rubble of my home, here in my neighborhood and among my neighbors." He is anxious, he said. He has no idea when reconstruction might begin or if it even will. "I fear that the wait for reconstruction will be long, that we will remain under tents forever, that these ruins will become our new home." That is an excerpt from A Graveyard of Stones by Rasha Abu Jalal on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israel has carried out a series of airstrikes and attacks on Palestinians in the north over the last week. On Wednesday, yesterday, 10 Palestinians were killed in an airstrike on Tamun near Tubas, according to the Wafa news agency. A Palestinian boy was shot and injured by Israeli forces in Tulkarm, also on Wednesday, as Israeli soldiers continued a three-day raid into the city. The United Nations reports that access to water and electricity has been disrupted in Tulkarm, and initial estimates suggest nearly 1,000 people have been displaced. On January 27th, Israeli forces carried out several raids around the Ramallah area. Meanwhile, the Israeli siege on Jenin and the Jenin refugee camp has continued for the second week. My colleague Tamara Nassar reported earlier this week that about 2,000 Palestinian families have been forcibly displaced from Jenin as a result of Israel's deadly raid. The Israeli invasion is a continuation of the Palestinian Authority's dirty work in the camp, she adds, which saw the killing of 15 Palestinians, including three children, between early December and January 17th, as the Israeli army now, quote, "seeks to reach several targets that PA forces have failed to," according to the Tel Aviv daily Haaretz. The news publication Arabs 48 reports that Israeli forces have expanded their military aggression, driving military vehicles and bulldozers into Jenin, demolishing and burning homes and destroying the local infrastructure. On Tuesday, Israeli forces demolished the Hamza Mosque in Jenin camp and raided Palestinians' homes in preparation for destroying them. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, said on Wednesday that Israeli army forces will continue to occupy Jenin refugee camp. In a video statement, Katz said, quote, "The camp will not return to what it was. Even after the operation ends, Israeli forces will stay to ensure that," quote, "terrorism does not return." Israeli soldiers have now killed at least 16 Palestinians and injured and arrested dozens, and at least 100 homes inside the camp have been destroyed, according to local news sources. On Sunday, January 26th, an Israeli sniper shot and killed a 16-year-old child, Adam Majdi Ahmed Sublaban, near the Qalandia checkpoint north of Jerusalem. Defense for Children International Palestine stated that Adam and two other children were walking in the area where no tensions were present. Adam was struck in the left thigh from behind, resulting in severe bleeding due to the injury to the femoral artery in the thigh. In occupied East Jerusalem, Israeli forces have reportedly arrested 12 Palestinians who celebrated the release of prisoners as part of the Gaza ceasefire. Israel's police and internal spy agency, the Shin Bet, said they arrested them after videos emerged showing them celebrating by waving Hamas flags and firing guns into the air. They alleged that the men violated a ban on expressions of joy and identification with Hamas that has been imposed since the ceasefire in Gaza took hold. The violent arrests in the context of the prohibition on expressions of joy by Israeli forces have prompted the Palestinian Prisoners Society to appeal to international mediators to intervene against, quote, systematic terrorism against released prisoners and their families. According to the prisoners' rights group, Israeli forces have threatened to bomb places where well-wishers of the released prisoners have gathered, while other released prisoners have faced rearrest and detention. On Monday, quote, Israeli forces summoned the released prisoner Ashwaq Awad to meet Israeli intelligence. In this context, the Palestinian Prisoners Society expressed its fears that Israel could rearrest the released prisoners, especially under Military Order No. 1651, which allows this to happen even under exchange deals. On Saturday, January 25th, Israeli forces shot and killed a 2-year-old girl, Leila Mohammed Ayman Khatib, while she ate dinner with her family in their home near Jenin, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. They say that Israeli soldiers shot 4 bullets through the living room window, one of which struck Leila in the back of the head. Leila's grandfather carried her out of the house and brought her to Al-Razi Hospital in Jenin, where she received emergency surgery. Leila was pronounced dead around 10 p.m., the rights group stated. Ayad Abu Akhtesh, Accountability Program Director at DCIP, stated, quote, Israeli forces regularly and routinely carry out military operations with complete contempt for Palestinian life. Little Leila was having dinner with her family when Israeli forces, unprompted, fired live ammunition into their living room, killing her. It is outrageous that the Israeli military has been permitted by world leaders to kill Palestinian children with impunity in flagrant violations of international law. Leila's mother and aunt sustained injuries from the shrapnel during the attack, according to information collected by DCIP. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq stated on Wednesday that, quote, the genocidal rhetoric and incitement from Israeli officials, which has characterized the atrocities in Gaza, is increasingly applied to all Palestinians. The decades-long failure of the international community and of high contracting parties to the Geneva Conventions to stand up against Israel's manifest violations of international law facilitates the climate of impunity by which Israeli authorities are perpetrating its genocidal, colonial violence against the Palestinian people. Al-Haq adds, to put an end to such violence, all states must immediately abide by their obligations under international law, particularly in light of the ICJ advisory opinion of July 2024, requiring that Israel end its illegal presence in and remove settlers from the occupied Palestinian territories. And in Lebanon, Israeli forces have injured dozens of people in the last 4 days, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. Under the terms of the ceasefire agreement, which was extended 3 more weeks last weekend after a 60-day truce, the Israeli army was expected to withdraw from southern Lebanon on Sunday. However, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said it would keep soldiers in the country beyond the deadline, Al Jazeera reported. The Reuters news agency reported that Israeli forces killed at least 24 people and wounded more than 140 in southern Lebanon on Sunday and Monday, the Lebanese health ministry said, as thousands of people tried to return to their homes in the area in defiance of Israeli military orders. In a speech on Monday, Hezbollah's Secretary General Naim Qassem said that Israel has violated the ceasefire in Lebanon 1,350 times, while the resistance group has upheld it. Quote, we are facing an occupation that continues to attack and refuses to withdraw, and the resistance has the right to determine how, when, and in what form it confronts them, Qassem stated. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to share images of people expressing determination and resilience in the aftermath of Israel's 15-month campaign of destruction and genocide. Cats and dogs were among the hundreds of thousands of people and their families returning home to the north. One cat named Busi came with her family to the south and was returning to the north. Her person says, quote, I love her a lot and got attached to her a lot during the war. Another young man holds three cats and says they're being returned to the north as well after being fed and looked after. Quote, learn humanity from the Gaza Strip, the man says. And a child with his small dog, Lucy, smiles as he walks to the north. And finally, our contributor Abu Bakr Abed posted these photos of graffiti along the road where Palestinians marched from the south to the north. The first one says, welcome to the land of the great. Here is Gaza. Number two says, greetings to you for what you have endured. The third says, enter in peace and safety. And the fourth one is a line from a famous poem that I'll leave for John to talk about later in his resistance report. But the hashtags all say the same thing. Here is Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague, Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Good to see you again.
Always good to see you. Yeah. We did get some breaking news I just saw as I was delivering my report. Did you want to talk about that before we bring on our guest?
Yeah, just as you were delivering your report, Hamas announced through its spokesperson, Abu Ubaida, rather the spokesperson of the Qassam Brigades, the military wing, that Mohammed Daif, the leader of the Qassam Brigades, the commander-in-chief, was indeed martyred during this war. According to Israel, claims that it had killed him in an airstrike in July, and Hamas has now just confirmed that he was martyred. So that is a significant piece of news, and it means that the two top leaders in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Daif, are now confirmed dead. And I think that makes it even more remarkable what we're seeing now and what we'll be talking about later, the complete coherence and cohesion of the resistance of Qassam as a resistance force, the command and control, the discipline that we continue to see. And it shows the utter futility of Israel's so-called decapitation strategy. It just hasn't worked.
And yet they keep trying. Well, thanks for that summary. We'll obviously talk more about that later on in the show, probably, and in the coming weeks, of course. But Ali, why don't you bring on our guest?
Sure. And just a reminder that you are watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abunama here with my colleague, Nora Burrows-Friedman. U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order on Wednesday pledging to deport college students on student visas and others who take part in protests calling for Palestinian rights. The civil rights group Palestine Legal said last month that our view is that Trump is in fact poised to escalate repression of the movement and undermine our constitutional rights to speak out and organize with many of the same tools that he will inherit from the Biden administration and its unwavering support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. During the genocide in Gaza, according to Palestine Legal, these tools of repression have included surveillance, arrests, criminal charges, lawsuits, false definitions of anti-Semitism that prevent criticism of Israel, McCarthyite congressional hearings, and weaponizing civil rights laws in an attempt to threaten university funding. Meanwhile, Harvard University has just settled a lawsuit brought by Zionist students who allege that Palestine solidarity activism on campus is a form of harassment. Student-led Palestine solidarity protests during Israel's genocide in Gaza were cited as a source of so-called anti-Semitic rhetoric against pro-Israel students. In addition to awarding the pro-Israel student group financial compensation, Harvard University has agreed to implement the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which has long been a goal of the Israel lobby, in fact, of the Israeli government and its lobby, that institutions use this definition. And under the IHRA definition, criticism of Israel and the policies of the state, as well as Israel's official ideology, Zionism, are considered anti-Jewish bigotry. Harvard also said it would provide training on combating anti-Semitism and that its Office for Community Conduct would incorporate the IHRA definition when reviewing complaints of discrimination. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, is one of many civil rights organizations that has expressed concern over Harvard's adoption of the IHRA definition and has warned the university of the dire consequences for Arab Americans and indeed anyone speaking up for Palestinian rights. In a statement, ADC said that, quote, with Harvard taking on this definition and setting a precedent, it is imperative that other universities do not follow suit. We reject the need for any legislative definition of anti-Semitism as it serves only to stifle necessary discourse rather than address true discrimination against Jewish people. And of course, the draconian government crackdowns on activists, students, and journalists engaged around justice for Palestine are escalating in many countries, especially in Europe, as I learned myself just in the last week. Joining us to talk about the repression of activists and journalists on and off college campuses is Abid Ayyub. Abid is the executive director of the ADC. Abid, it's so great to have you back on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you, Ali. It's great to see you and have you back as well, and appreciate, you know, being on here with you and talking about this issue, which really over the past week we've, you know, seen how it can impact us directly.
Yeah, thank you, Abid. And really, before anything else, I want to take this opportunity to thank you and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee for the unqualified statement of support for me that you made after I was arbitrarily detained in Switzerland. Of course, it wasn't just a defense of me as an individual, but of all our fundamental rights. And knowing that you are there for us and our community really empowers us to keep doing our work. So I truly appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's talk about the executive order signed yesterday by Donald Trump, threatening those on student visas with deportation if they criticize Israel or express a positive opinion of Hamas. As a civil rights lawyer and legal expert, how do you analyze the impact this could have on students, their right to free speech, and of course, their right to protest colonialism and genocide?
This is going to have a significant impact. And I think the impact is starting now, right, where whenever there's an attack on free speech and freedom of expression, the first intent of those doing the attacking, the first intent is to stifle speech to give that chilling effect. So we're already hearing from international students and many of the national student groups in the country that, you know, most of their international student members are backing off, or they're afraid to stay engaged, or they don't want to be at protests or be as visible as they were. That's the first immediate impact. And that shows, you know, the intention of this is to stifle these voices that are standing up for justice and for Palestine. Moving forward, you know, the threat of taking away the visa simply because somebody is speaking up, this needs to be a concern for all Americans, everyone in the country, not just Arabs or Muslims or Palestinians. These tactics, giving this precedent to a president and authority to the government to deport you, arrest you, go after you, it's going to start with international students, but it's not going to stop there. We're going to see attack on journalists. We're going to see attack on others coming into this country, speakers. And I do want to keep in mind that there's two orders. There was the one signed yesterday, and then there was the one signed on his first day, which, you know, kind of went around the same lines of attack. The same, you know, they were threatening us around the same thing. Sorry, my phone. And these coupled together, it's an attack on free speech. It's an attack on our identity and who we are. And it's attack not just on us, on our allies. Remember, you know, we're not talking here that every international student is Palestinian or Arab. We have a limited number of international students in this country. So the international students they're going to be going after, they're going to see like a diverse, the diversity. They're going to see students from across the world. So it is something to be concerned thing, something that we're, you know, we should be watching and all Americans should be, you know, concerned of right now.
Abed, there are probably international students watching this program. I know that you can't give sort of specific legal advice to anyone, but in a general sense, what are their rights? Do they have the same constitutional right to free speech as a US citizen or a legal permanent resident? What can you say about that?
What I would say is this. We are, the strategy from the other side is to constantly move the goalposts. It's to constantly keep changing what anti-Semitism is, keep trying to redefine it, and trying to take anything we say to mean anti-Semitism. But what these executive orders do is they're going to be adding like a criminal component to things. So anybody that's here on a visa, whether a student visa or a B1, B2 visitor visa, if they commit a crime or they're arrested, most likely you lose your visa. So what we're going to see within the next 60 days is a layout from the Department of Justice saying, we are going to go after students for trespassing. We're going to go after students for graffiti or vandalism. That underlying charge is what's going to be used as the technical reason why they're going to lose their visa or they're going to be kicked out of the country. So my advice would be this, continue speaking up, continue taking part. I'll never say sit back and don't engage in your First Amendment right or don't stand up for Palestine or for what you believe in, but do it in a way where you're vigilant and not alarmist. So I would advise international students, for example, from shutting down traffic or taking part in these civil disobedience where you see folks, you know, willingly get arrested. Like, don't take part in those. Figure out for the time being how you can best be involved, where you can be best used, because your voice is stronger when you're here, when you're committed, when you're getting your education, you're doing your part rather than being, you know, removed and unplugged from the movement. So it's be vigilant, not alarmist right now.
That's important. Thank you so much, Abed. And I mean, meanwhile, you know, Harvard University is already facing backlash over its adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism and how it's really bending over backwards to dangerously conflate Judaism with Zionism on behalf of Israel lobby groups and Zionist student organizations and the Israeli government itself. Inside Higher Education this week highlighted a statement written by the university's Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine group, which says, quote, in accepting the IHRA definition, Harvard has proved itself to be amenable to political pressure rather than intellectual debate. A political scientist and the director of Harvard's Nonviolent Action Lab resigned in protest over the university's as he said, a response to the genocide in Gaza and deepening repression of campus activism around it. He cited the use of the IHRA definition as the final push to leave in his open letter of resignation. How can civil rights organizations like the ADC intervene against the adoption of these policies, such as the IHRA, or protect students and activists if these policies are greenlit? I mean, you know, we talked about free speech, but this is a different level.
This is a different level. And this is the first time we see, someone trying to adopt a definition of hate. We don't see a definition of anti-Black or anti-Arab or Islamophobia. This is beyond any of that. And, you know, as we've been saying, this does water down and this does take away from the fight against real anti-Semitism. And a number of the students and a number of the individuals who've approached ADC for assistance over the past year and a half, are actually Jewish students. They're not Arab or Palestinian or Muslim students. We've had a number of Jewish students call us because of what they're facing, right? And the anti-Semitism they're facing. So I think you're going to see that conversation happen from the Jewish community, who's going to be, they're also going to be negatively impacted by this. They're going to be discriminated against. They're going to be targeted as well by these institutions. And, you know, we have to work at putting together our legal strategies, putting together our approaches, but keeping pressure on institutions, state AGs and other lawmakers, and, you know, on a state level, who have, you know, are on the fence about this, but letting them know we don't need to adopt the definition. You don't need to go this route, and keep fighting that way. For those that have adopted it, it's going to be litigation. It's going to be like a legal strategy moving forward once it's implemented.
And Abed, tell us about, if you can, about what you're seeing from a bird's eye view on campuses across the United States. Are you seeing an uptick in complaints of harassment and discrimination and targeting of Palestinian students, Arab students, or other students who are simply exercising their right to free speech? What can you tell us about that, let's say, over the last 16 months since the genocide began?
We are seeing an uptake in discrimination and complaints against our students. I would say this, it's a coordinated effort. You're seeing it, you know, you're seeing the harassment of our students at the smallest campuses and the largest campuses. I mean, it's a coordinated effort to go after them, to, you know, bait them, to get them to get into arguments, and they fail, and then they just start harassing the Palestinian students, the encampments. But I do want to add this. On the most part, many universities, smaller universities, mid-sized universities that may not be in the media or may not be well-known, they've been fair. The administration has, you know, protected the students. They've given them space. But it's these hotbed areas like Columbia, NYU, Harvard that get most of the attention. You're seeing, the resources they're putting into quieting the movement. And, you know, unfortunately, they can take this strategy to other campuses. They have the resources to do it. But on the most part, we are seeing an uptick. Unfortunately, we're seeing it from professors, from the administration, from outside groups. It's coming from all directions. It has been coming from all directions over the past 16 months.
And if I could just follow up, Nora. And then, you know, what we saw were during the first Trump administration, when Trump was imposing the so-called Muslim ban and other measures that would target international students or scholars, all these universities put on a pose of we are the champions of academic freedom and free speech, and we're going to protect and defend our students against this. You said some of the smaller or campuses or the ones that are not in the limelight are being fair, but what do you think the situation is now? Are these prestige universities like Harvard and Columbia basically on the same side as Donald Trump? Are they going to be ganging up on our students and scholars? Is that what we can expect?
Yes, that's what we can expect. The order that he signed on the 20th, you know, the ideological exclusion order, that's a dangerous one. That allows for the cancellation of visas or for folks already in the U.S. if there's disagreement with their ideology. We saw this post 9/11. They can deny visas now if they're, you know, they deem that the applicant has the wrong ideology or view of America. So going after these students, going after folks that have already admitted here, that's dangerous. We have to see how the universities are going to apply, but we're already seeing courses canceled, lectures canceled. They're caving in. And the thing is, they're aligning with Donald Trump on this, but I do want to say, it's not like Donald Trump is aligning with his base on this, right? We're also seeing many on the right, many from the Republican Party. They're like, hey, wait a minute. You know, we value our First Amendment rights in this country. We value our freedom of speech, our freedom of expression. What the hell is going on here, right? We're going to see this, I think, become a universal issue where you're going to see folks on the right, folks on the left say, enough. We don't want our rights taken away for a foreign government. So we are noticing that trend, and you're going to start seeing some Republican lawmakers also come out, you know, against what's happening, and I anticipate that happening soon.
Does ADC, you're not a political lobby group in the traditional sense, you're a civil rights organization, or you tell us the range of things you do, but are you talking to lawmakers across the political spectrum in the U.S., as narrow as that spectrum is? But
of course. Of course, yes. Look, we're nonpartisan. We talk to lawmakers and from both parties, and we engage with lawmakers from both parties, as long as they stand principally where we are. And I think that right now is very important, because the way this administration is set up, the way our politics is set up, it's upside down. Our traditional way of communicating, traditional way of outreach is gone. And, you know, relying solely on the Democratic Party or Democratic lawmakers, that's not going to get you anywhere. So there is a realignment of a political realignment happening here of coalitions, allies on these issues. And I think the First Amendment is central to a lot of what we're seeing.
Knowing your rights is a very important tactic for activists and students, especially around Palestine. Can you remind us what our rights are? Do they still even exist under these forms of aggressive and intimidating repression aimed at civil rights, and especially aimed at Palestine rights campaigners? You know, if you could break this down in terms of students or faculty on visas, on campuses on the one hand, and at the border on the other, what do we all need to know whether or not we are U.S. citizens, and how can we find out more and really, understand deeper what our rights are?
Well, look, as U.S. citizens, I don't anticipate they're going to be going after you for speaking up or for being vocal. As I said, you know, that's your right. That's what you have the ability to do. The scary part is them finding a way to criminalize it, going for some underlying criminal action to get you and to target you and to make your life difficult. So U.S. citizens are going to have more protections, more options, particularly on the border, by saying, no, I don't want to give you the right to search my phone. You got to let me in, right? Those exist now. Those that are on student visas or non-immigrant visas or immigrant visas coming into the U.S., their rights are a little bit more limited at the border. You could tell a CBP officer or someone, I don't want to give you my phone, but they're going to tell you, okay, we're going to send you right back, or we're going to cancel your visa, or even like the ideological exclusion question. Oh, well, you know, you agreed with so-and-so, or I see these pictures in your WhatsApp, we're going to deny you entry. So we have to be careful in that. Like what I would advise for those that are here on visas, when you're traveling into the country, delete WhatsApp off your phone, come in with a clean slate on WhatsApp, and, you know, have your things in order when you do enter. But those that are already in here, you know, speak up, use common sense. Don't move away from protesting or having your voice heard, but understand that there is a movement out there against us that is acting in a way that's brazen, that's open, and trying really to defy a lot of what we're against traditionally when it comes to going after our First Amendment rights. So they are using tactics that are frightening, but we'll take them on. But, you know, there is a sense of responsibility we have to have. Like I said, don't take part in anything that could get you arrested. Don't take part in any civil disobedience actions. Don't take part in like any graffiti or any of that. Use your voice in the more traditional ways when it comes to protesting. And, you know, I hate saying that or putting limits, but I promise you, immediately if a visa holder is put in handcuffs, you can bet that they're going to lose their visa and they're going to be removed. So, you know, use common sense, get out there. And again, if you feel threatened or you feel they're targeting you, contact an organization like ADC, will help you. If you're a professor or you're an administrator and you feel like you're being targeted for your positions, even as a visa holder, you contact an attorney or ADC, because you do have rights as an employee of these institutions. So if you're on J-1 or H-1B, they can't be discriminating against you. And they, you know, there's a whole subset of rights afforded to those folks as well as employees that will protect them.
Abed, I just want to sort of break this down a little bit further. So you talked about U.S. citizens. of course, they could find ways, and they have in the past found ways to harass U.S. citizens or make their life more difficult. But in general, U.S. citizens have the highest level of protection. They have to let you in the country. Yeah. If you're coming in from overseas, they can't prevent you coming in the country, and right. they can't force you to let them search your phone or your laptop. Yeah. They are not allowed to force you to answer questions about your ideology or your religion or anything else. If you're a U.S. citizen coming into the United States and they ask you for any of those things, you can say, I don't consent to any search. I don't want to answer any questions. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
All right. Correct. Now, you've already talked about people who are on non-immigrant visas. So that might be people like people who are on student visas, who probably are the most precarious, the most vulnerable, where you're saying use more traditional forms of speech, don't engage in any kind of civil disobedience where you might get arrested. And that sounds fairly reasonable. What about people who are legal permanent residents, otherwise known as green card holders? They're people who are allowed to live in the United States indefinitely without a time limit. Sure. Is there a gray area there? What do you say to them?
That's a great question. So green card holders do have rights, and we all have visa holders, green card holders have right to the First Amendment. Now with the green card holders, there are rules that will trigger a removal or deportation. If you are arrested for certain things, you can then be deemed removable from the U.S. And that's when the retainers happen, the ICE detainers. So if a green card holder is protesting, hypothetically, let's say they're arrested for blocking traffic and they're detained here at the Washington, D.C., prison or jail, a notice would be sent to ICE. If there's a working agreement between local officials and ICE, a notice would be sent to ICE saying, hey, we got a green card holder here. Here's some arrests, and then things would be done to put that person in removal, and they would ultimately lose their green card. So it is possible if you are arrested for certain things, you can lose your green card. That has happened. And even if you have your green card, you're arrested, and then years from now you want to go get your citizenship, that arrest may come back again. You have to re-explain yourself, and you could be at a possibility of not being able to get your citizenship. So it is a something that green card holders need to be aware of. We have seen folks, not related to protests, but we've worked with many individuals who've lost their green card for reasons related to arrests or legal trouble.
And if whether or not you're a U.S. citizen, if police or the FBI come to your door, what are your rights? What should you do? Should you let them in, or should you call a lawyer?
That's the quick answer is call a lawyer. Don't feel like you know more than them. Don't feel like you're smarter than them. They may be nice. You feel like maybe you have nothing to hide, but you never know what they're there for. You never know what they're trying to get. So I would just call an attorney. Don't fall into the trap of thinking these guys are your friends or they're here. They may be the sweetest people in the world, but do not let them in. Do not engage with them. Call an attorney, have an attorney there with you, have the interview if that's what you want to do, but consult with a lawyer right away.
And I just wanted to ask, like, what numbers should people save in their phone to call, if someone's, in their 20s or, 40s and they don't have like a lawyer on retainer, what's the best person to call?
You know what? We have a 800 number. It's 844-ADC-9955. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can call. There'll be a human that'll answer. Take your information, get a quick intake from you, and then our attorneys are immediately notified. And if it's something that is involving an arrest or an FBI visit or something, it is elevated, and we respond almost as fast as we can. And then we try to immediately connect you with an attorney in your city if we're unable to get out there.
That's really an incredible resource and so important to know. And again, I'm coming to some basics, and this is very much on my mind because I've just been through this, albeit in another country, but there are a lot of similarities. When I was arrested last Saturday, the first thing I said is, I want a lawyer. I want to talk to a lawyer. And I refuse to be questioned or talk to police without a lawyer. Is that what people should also do in the United States?
They should. They should talk to a lawyer. Now, Ali, what you went through, you know, I was explaining to somebody here, what you went through is kind of like the accelerated process of what happens here. Unfortunately, in the U.S., you know, the end result is the same. But this individual, if this had happened to you here, the individual is spending weeks in a detention center or in a holding cell, right? So it's a much slower process here. And, you know, that's intentionally done just to keep you, you know, regretting your choice of ever coming to the U.S. and having you leave. And rules are a little bit different in immigration holding facilities. They may not give you time to call a lawyer, or they may skip over your time or ignore you. So it is important that you have, you know, if somebody is here as a student visa and they're engaging or they feel, you know, they're at risk, share your information with a friend or with a family member that's in the U.S., copy of your passport, copy of your I-20, your basic information, just in the event, you know, something does happen. That person, that individual can turn that information over to an attorney and work to find you and work to assist you while you're, you know, in detention.
One other question I want to get, or one other thing I want to get you to comment on. If the FBI or the police come to your door, you've already said you don't have to talk to them. You're not required to talk to them. And in fact, you probably shouldn't. You should just say to them, if you want, give me your card and I'll get my lawyer to call you. And you don't let them in your house, you don't talk to them. But another thing that I've heard, and I want you to tell us if it's accurate or not, is that the FBI and the police are allowed to lie to you. They're allowed to lie about why they're there. And they're allowed to lie about what they know about you or what they don't know. But if you lie to them, that could, and that could land you in prison.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not worth lying. It's not worth just having that conversation without a lawyer. Don't lie to them. Don't engage. Like you said, take their business card and go, because they will lie to you. Again, they will say, oh, we're your friend, or we're here. We just want to make sure you're safe. We just want to make sure no one is threatening you. And then one thing leads to another and you find yourself in legal trouble. So don't lie to them. That's why you should have the attorney there with you to make sure, you know, everything you say is in order and not going to get you in trouble.
And then we've been talking about the United States because of Donald Trump's order, but we have viewers all over the world. Many countries where we have viewers have very similar legal systems. Could be Canada, could be the UK. There are differences in these systems, but many of these general principles apply in those countries as well. And people who are in those countries who are concerned about these things should probably brush up on what their rights are in their own countries in terms of if they're at a protest and they're arrested, or which has been happening a great deal, especially in the UK, where we're seeing people charged for tweets, criminally charged for tweets, criminally charged for signs they're carrying at protests, where there are far fewer protections for free speech. So although we may not have the expertise about each and every country, it's a good general principle, do you think, Abed, for people to brush up on their rights?
Absolutely, absolutely. Brush up on your rights, find the local attorney or find your local version of ADC or the National Lawyers Guild. They are in a lot of these countries out there, you know, attorneys ready to support and help, but you do want to have this information on hand, particularly if you're part of the movement and part of the activities and the protests that have been going on. Very important to do so.
And if go ahead.
No, go ahead, Nora.
If you could give out the number for your hotline once more, Abed, and also tell us how we can reach you online as well.
Sure. It's 844-ADC-9955. Our website is adc.org, and our email is legal@adc.org. So you can get a hold of us anyway, and we'll do our best to respond.
So adc.org is probably a good place to start.
Yes.
Abed, thank you so much for joining us. This is critical information, and we always learn from you. And thank you for the work you're doing for the community. It's never been more vital. And We hope to have you back again.
I appreciate you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Abed.
Oh, that's good. We always need to brush up on our rights.
Yeah, it's scary times, and listening to that can be very discouraging. But, you know, just as I said in our last program, we have to be prepared, and we have to stand up for each other and not back down. And in every movement, there are people who are more vulnerable, people who have more protection. So when you're working together with people in a movement, there are people who can take on some tasks that perhaps others can't, but there's always something someone can do. So if you're a student and you feel you're particularly vulnerable and you don't want to go out and be in the front line of protests or civil disobedience, there's probably a lot of other things you can do in terms of research, in terms of, I don't know, helping to make signs, or there are always ways that people can be involved and not just withdraw completely in fear. And I think that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that's what they want. This is the whole impetus for these kinds of draconian legislation or policies or adoption of these, just spurious and awful definitions of anti-Semitism. They're meant to make you self-censor and to remove you from the movement and to make standing up for Palestinian rights a liability. And so, you know, the ADC, Palestine Legal, Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU, all of the National Lawyers Guild, all of these organizations do incredible work. And it's always a good time to brush up. So thank you. Let's bring on John. Hey, John.
Hi, guys. Great segment.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks, John. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
A lot of breaking news happening right now while I'm behind this camera.
A lot. I know.
Is there more that has happened?
There is more, yes.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, the prisoner swap is underway right now.
Prisoner swap is happening.
Yeah.
We're not a 24/7 breaking news channel, but
we do our best
sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know the loss of this Qassam leadership is very significant, and I think it was an open question throughout the war. Qassam had acknowledged the leadership of, Muhammad al-Dayf and Marwan Issa are the top leaders, but Qassam had acknowledged the deaths of their senior most leadership. So it was always an open question whether they would ignore or postpone or how they would handle with announcing the death of Mohammed Daif, the chief of staff, and Marwan Issa, who is his operations chief. And so just 5 minutes ago, we found out the answer to that. So significant losses to the movement, no question. And but also, I think, because we're talking about something that happened in July, so the capacity for the resistance to carry on and to replace this leadership is very doable. And these are very significant losses, institutional losses, operational losses. There's no question about that. But the organization is able to fill those spots with and we're going to find in history, I'm sure, just as qualified people to replace them. And so that's always what we say about assassinations. I don't want to understate because it's a very, very significant loss. But obviously the group is able to fight and not lose its way without these leaders. So, and that has always been the case, because assassination of Qassam leaders is the price of being the leaders of the resistance. It always has been. And so for Mohammed al-Dayf, he will go down in history as the architect of the October 7th operation and the road to freedom for Palestinians. Marwan Issa is less known, but he is a critical operations chief that has been so for the last, the last 10 years since Ahmed Jabari was assassinated. So Marwan Issa is a big loss, lesser known name, maybe a lesser known name than certainly than al-Dayf, but Very significant news. And next week on the show, we will dig into this.
And interestingly, now with this confirmation today, the three Hamas leaders who were indicted by the International Criminal Court have now been confirmed dead. So Ismail Haniyeh, Yahya Sinwar, and Mohammed Daif. So now the only two outstanding arrest warrants arising out of the events of October 7th are on Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant.
And it's also interesting to note that Israel clearly had no idea that he was killed, because they announced it spread out over weeks. They were unable to provide any proof to the ICC, because the ICC, as you just said, quashes those indictments, and they were unable to do that. So they were listed in the indictments, which came after the assassination. So, yeah, very significant. There's three or four more senior leaders that they're announcing right now that are coming out minute by minute. So,
all right. Well, let's go to the resistance report, and then we can talk more about that afterwards.
Sounds good. All right, so this is the resistance report for day 482 since October 7th, ceasefire day 12. It is January 30th, and I'm going to cover the prisoner exchange that took place in Gaza City on the 25th of January. This is the second exchange of the first phase of the prisoner exchange, which is part of 33 releases of Israeli captives for 2,000 Palestinian detainees and security prisoners, broken down about 1,200 from Gaza, 735, 1,200 from Gaza who were detained after October 7th, not charged with any crimes, taken to the brutal torture camps at Sidi Tamim and elsewhere in the Israeli south. They will be released, and this was the exchange for four prisoners of war, women soldiers from the IDF, from the Israeli military, that were captured at Nahal Oz base, military base, on the 7th of October. And just before we get to the video, I want to just give you some context of this. This release happened in Palestine Square. This is in the Al Ramal neighborhood, downtown Gaza City, the commercial hub of downtown Gaza City. And on December 20th, 2023, the Israeli military claimed operational control over this in a statement. They said, IDF troops have secured control over Hamas's elite quarter in the center of Gaza City, including the area of Palestine Square, from where the Hamas administrative and military leadership operated. The complex includes a large network of tunnels that connects underground hideouts, bureaus, residential apartments belonging to Hamas senior leadership, and the complex both above and below ground was a center of power for Hamas that we have destroyed. In recent weeks, the 401st Brigade and 162nd Division, along with forces from Shaldag, Sheatet 13, this is Flotilla 13, their special forces units, and the Yahalom tunnel units have been operating in the area where Palestine Square is located. The forces carried out combined and coordinated offensives in Palestine Square and took operational control over the area. Over the last few days, the area was completely secured and dismantled. So that's Palestine Square. That's the Israelis claiming defeat of Palestine Square on December 20th, 2023. That's critical, because if we can go to video number one, you're going to see that area right now and clearly see that this is an area not under operational control and not destroyed. So this is the video that Qassam released. I have edited out the prisoners of war. We're not going to show the prisoners, the female prisoners, but there you can see saluting the police. So the police are on the ground. The government is intact. Hamas police is intact. Gaza's police is intact. This is the Qassam Brigades and Saraya al-Quds both intact. You're seeing obviously a well-organized situation with hundreds, if not thousands, of fighters holding the area. And this is the handover of the four. Like I said, I edited out the four women soldiers. They were hyping up the crowd up on stage. They were given gift baskets for their time, souvenir baskets. They looked like they were well taken care of, and they testified that they were well taken care of. This is the official handover here that we're watching. And like I said, I cut the part out with the soldiers. We aren't going to show the prisoners of war, but it was a very key part of this because of the way that they looked and celebrated and spoke of their time in captivity and thanked in Arabic they thanked their guards in Arabic for taking care of them, for protecting them against bombing. They spoke about how they learned Arabic with their guards' children. The women said they were never left alone with men, and the four of them were always together throughout this entire time. Well fed, they said they were taught to share their food before eating and other Palestinian societal norms. They were treated very well, and again, thanked for protecting the bombings. What we're looking at here is hundreds, if not thousands, of Qassam and Saraya fighters. The fighters were not defeated. We saw the Gaza police. They didn't defeat the government. And we saw thousands of cheering civilians and women and children who were at this event in itself. So number two is the exchange of the paperwork. This is a very formal process. This is the release of four. We're going to see the release of 33 in phase one. And this exchange was for 200 Palestinian prisoners with life sentences or long sentences, divided up as 21 life sentences and 79 long sentences. The oldest prisoner released was 69 years old, and the youngest was 15. And they broke down as 81 Hamas and Qassam, 23 Saraya al-Quds and Islamic Jihad, 13 Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades and Fatah. 130 were sent to the West Bank. 70 were exiled outside of the country to Tunisia, Algeria, and Turkey primarily. And as I said, this is the second exchange today, as we're on air. The third exchange is happening for an additional soldier, a civilian, and an elderly civilian that's in the humanitarian part of this exchange. These people could have all been exchanged in November during the prisoner exchange in November 2023. Israel refused to give Qassam a couple extra days to find these captives that they weren't holding, which is what you're seeing here, and why it took this time for them to be in the second release. If we look at number three, this was quite a propaganda effort by Qassam that was very, very directly aimed at the Israelis. Most people don't notice these kind of little details that we've got here on the stage. We're looking at the stage, but the Israelis noticed, and they were very upset with the symbols of defeat of their military after 16 months of this war, after the embarrassment, the humiliation, the dismantling of their military on October 7th, and the sense of pride they had in their military. We're looking at the banners here. The banners say Al-Aqsa flood is a revolution against Zionist injustice. Gaza is the graveyard for criminal Zionists. That's what it says above the stage there. It says victory of the oppressed versus Nazi Zionism. And it says Palestinian freedom fighters will be victorious. Now, underneath there, you see in Hebrew, it says Zionism will be defeated, over the logos of the key military and intelligence units that have fought in the Gaza Strip. So you can see that being directly a message to the Israelis. And then underneath at the far bottom, you can see the faces, and that's the faces of the military leadership. The IDF, the units that the Qassam Brigades have on there are military intelligence, the Amman unit, that's the unit that failed on October 7th, and the Homeland Command, which also failed on October 7th. The 162nd Division is the other logo you see there. That's the division that fought in Gaza for the entire war. Also, the Gaza Division crest is there. The IDF Gaza Division was dismantled on October 7th, as well as the Armored Corps. And for people who have been watching the Resistance Report segments for 15 months, it's the Armored Corps that's taken the beating from the resistance. So very direct, very pointed. Each one of those logos are significant choices. They're not just picked from the wiki page or whatever. These are very pointedly directed at the Israeli audience. The military and political figures are many of the people that you would know. Netanyahu, the chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, Southern Command Chief Yaron Finkelman. Herzi Halevi has resigned because of the failure of October 7th. He will leave his position in March. Yaron Finkelman, also the Southern Command Chief, he has also resigned. If we look at the next slide, you'll see the Qassam fighters with their boots on the heads of the defeated leaders. And on, you could see the red over it, the red over each of the faces of the leadership says failed. You failed in your mission, which is what this video shows, what all these details show. And if we look at the next one, this one was a particular shot in the gut for the Israelis. The weapons being held there are Tavor bullpup rifles used by Israeli Special Forces units, which Qassam captured on October the 7th. And on each side of the stage, there was fighters holding those captured Israeli weapons. These are weapons made by the Israel weapons industry. So everyone in Israel knows this rifle. Channel 12 was very upset about this, said Hamas cleverly planned the handover, showing off Tavor rifles as war booty and including fighters from elite units at the scene of that were reminiscent of the October defeat for the Israelis. The Tavor weapon, I showed you this before because in the 2014 raid on Nahal Oz base, the tunnel operation where Palestinian fighters came up from a tunnel across the border and attacked the base, one of the soldiers at that base had his Tavor bullpup rifle literally pulled from his hands during that operation. And that rifle went back to Gaza and was used in multiple places. We're going to talk more about the Al Jazeera documentary later in the program and also next show, but Izzedine Al-Haddad, who's the top Qassam commander, he had one of the Tavors beside him in the interview on Al Jazeera. So these are very potent weapons that are potently symbolic weapons of the capture and defeat. So there's one more of those shot from the other side of the screen. Number seven, yeah. It was difficult to get both of the shots in because the women are on the stage in the middle and we're going to not show them, as said. So that is the prisoner exchange. That is exchange two of the exchange. Exchange three is happening right now while we're on air. And then each Saturday over the next 4 weeks, there will be additional releases staged. This was the only one that will be on a Thursday. The other ones will be are planned to be on Saturday for each of the next weeks. And then the final week will be 14 released. And so that is into March when that will have happened. So that is the prisoner exchange. I want to take a look because the prisoner exchange opened up the Netzarim corridor. And I've been reporting on the Netzarim corridor since November of 2023 when Israel took it. We have changed the shape and size of it to adapt to the Israeli position. The Netzarim corridor is an Israeli military position that goes back to the 1967 war when Israel took control of the Gaza Strip. The goal was to make a plan called the Five Fingers Plan, where Gaza would be cut up into strips to more easily facilitate the control of the indigenous population. In 1972, Israel put a settlement there, which is how Israel operates. You make a military base in a key position to divide up the territory, and then you move civilian populations into that base, and that's how you get the justification, the legitimacy of the base. So it's a military base with a civilian presence that was from 1972 until 2005. And as a product of the Second Intifada, the Netzarim Corridor was dismantled in defeat in 2005 after the Second Intifada. The Second Intifada in Gaza, the Second Intifada begins at Al-Aqsa in Jerusalem. But it immediately spreads throughout Palestine. And in Gaza, it first flared up at the Netzarim corridor. And people may remember the very symbolic death of Mohammed Al-Dura, a Palestinian child who was killed in his father's arms. That was at the Netzarim junction on its way into Netzarim corridor. In the second Intifada, the Netzarim corridor was often cut off by resistance operations. Things had to be airlifted into the Netzarim corridor. It was a key checkpoint as well. So this, what we're seeing is the most on the screen right now is the most that the corridor got in size over the course of this war, 7 kilometers wide. Israel boasted that this was the strategic victory that it had from the war, because they obviously, we all knew that they were not defeating Qassam. They were not going to have an absolute victory. And so what Netanyahu did was he moved to these corridors, saying these corridors were the victory, because these corridors would allow Israel to move in and jump off in the middle of the Gaza Strip and attack Gaza City to the north, as you see, and to the south into the middle camps, which allows Israel to carry out essentially policing actions, which is what they intended to do with the failure to defeat Qassam. So the fact that the prisoner exchange led to the removal of the Netzarim corridor is significant. If we look at map B tomorrow, we can see how the map, this is how we started with the Netzarim corridor. This was the original size. Then Israel, as it was clear it was not going to get total victory, expanded the size of the corridor. And Israeli television was also very upset about this, the taking down of the Netzarim corridor. On Channel 14, they talked about the soldiers who left the Netzarim corridor, IDF soldiers left Netzarim corridor in tears from Netzarim, feeling that everything they did for months in Gaza is going down the drain. So a significant defeat in the Netzarim corridor. If we look at the next image, we can see the way that the Israelis announced this after the prisoner exchange that took place on Saturday. On Sunday, the Israelis announced that the Al-Rashid coastal road would be open. That's what we're looking at here. Everybody in Gaza was waiting for this map, because this release, as you can see, 27 January, this was the Israeli military acknowledging that people could return home at 7 a.m. on foot along the Al-Rashid coastal road, and at 9 a.m. by car along Salah ad-Din road, where they would get inspections. So Salah ad-Din road runs through the red territory, and the coastal road goes up. This is a very significant victory and a very significant defeat of the Israeli military. A significant victory because this is the corridor that people were pushed out of Gaza City in the beginning, all through the north, Gaza City and north, were pushed down through the coastal road. So this was the return. The Gaza media office yesterday announced that 500,000 people already had returned back to the north. And in the north is devastated, of course. 90% of houses are damaged or destroyed. There was amazing footage of people returning home in celebration, but there's also devastating footage of people realizing that they can't even find where their homes were. Everything is so destroyed that there's no landmarks. People can't figure out even where their houses were because so much is destroyed. But we saw on the show on Tuesday that we did with Ali, showed people cleaning up, painting, doing what they can, and greeting them on the other side. So if we look at map 7C here, you can see this is from the ceasefire proposal. So on foot up the corridor, people can walk freely up and down the corridor. The yellow area marked is the part of the Netzarim corridor that the Israeli military is under control of, but that is the road you see cutting through there is the Salah ad-Din road. That is the major highway that goes north to south in Gaza. And there are private security companies doing the checks of the cars on the road. Two U.S. companies and an Egyptian partner. The contractors are North North Carolina-based UG Solutions and Safe Reach Solutions of Wyoming. They will be authorized to search vehicles and confiscate any weapons or military materiel, but the vehicles and whoever is inside them, including Hamas personnel, will be allowed to pass. This is a significant victory for Hamas in the negotiations, because the fact that this is not an Israeli military checkpoint is something that the Palestinians refuse to give in to through 15 months of genocide and destruction. And this is the day, these 3 days have been the days that those came to fruition. Because if there was a military checkpoint on those points, it would be a spot where Israel would arrest more people and take them to detention. Israel calls them the drains, disgustingly, along with a lot of their disgusting vernacular. But those are checkpoints are the reason why people don't want to go back home, because they don't want to end up getting captured there. Under the Washington Post, it says travelers, quote, are going to go through the checkpoint, and we are not going to stop them. They just can't carry anything deemed unsafe, said UG Solutions official. The Washington Post said under the terms of the deal requiring non-Israeli inspections, the contractors have no offensive mandate, no military mission, and no ability to detain combatants. So significant victory there. If we look at 7D, is that 7D? Or let's look at some of the photos of people returning through the corridor that was defeated. It's remarkable pictures. We showed some of them on Tuesday, number 8 here. It was just a remarkable moment. The amount of just brutal cruelty that people went through after being pushed out of the north to go home, seeing this footage on Monday morning, Sunday night in our time, Monday morning local time, was just remarkable. This started happening before 7 a.m. and people were walking on foot. And you can see from that footage that people aren't really carrying things. They just have what more or less what was on their clothes on their back, and some have backpacks. Just remarkable victory, the defeat of the Netzarim corridor. I've been reporting on this for since November. So this is a momentous occasion to mark the defeat of the Netzarim corridor. So also this week, Qassam released videos from the Beit Hanun operations that I've been talking about on the last few shows that we had field reports from. This is, again, I'm reporting this on January 30th, and these videos were released on Friday the 24th and Sunday the 26th of January, so in the time since you last saw me on the show. And they were released late from Beit Hanun because of operational and security reasons, considerations. And we have seen this happen before. Qassam did it in the early summer in the Shujaiya operation, the reinvasion of Shujaiya. And they released the videos after the Israeli military pulled out. There's lots of technical and security reasons why they would do that. It's just good practice, to be honest. The fact that they're able to get videos out so fast sometimes seems like it's risky. But this is the product. If we look at number 10, the map of the north, the north was under siege for 100 days, 5,000 people killed, 9,500 people wounded, 6,000 people detained. The end of the war that Israel wanted was to brutalize the north and make them make it be ethnically cleansed. They wanted to push people out of the rest of the north before the ceasefire agreement was agreed to. And the ceasefire agreement was agreed to in large measure because of these operations that we've seen. Israel believed that they were under control, that they had the north completely under control. The Jabalia camp, Beit Lahia, had been completely wiped out. That's where Kamal Adwan Hospital is, that they dismantled. The Jabalia camp was attacked, but Israel indicated that they were going to attack all of the north, Jabalia, Gaza City, Tufa, Daraj, Shujaiya, Tel Hawa. All these places were supposed to be on the Israeli operations ticket because they hadn't won the war. They clearly hadn't won the war. But these operations that we're going to see, these are called the Ambushes of Death series that Qassam released this week. They give you a pretty good indication why Israel moved towards a ceasefire. If we look at slide number 10B, this is an article from Le Monde from the Paris newspaper from November 2023, they declared on a military embed with the Israelis that Beit Hanun is not only dead, Beit Hanun no longer exists. They went into tunnels with the Israeli military that were the part of this. And these tunnels that Israel claimed to have destroyed and had operational control over in Beit Hanun by December of 2023 are the tunnels that were used to carry out these operations that we're seeing now. We see 17 operations in the Ambushes of Death series in two videos. I can't show them all. They're remarkable operations that are too graphic, too obvious to show on this program. Even with heavy editing, they couldn't be showed because they're so devastating to the Israeli military. But I've pulled together a few of the key operations to give you a sense of what these operations were looking like and why the Israelis were saying what they were saying about Beit Hanun when they thought it was completely wiped out and was not. So let's look at number 11 here. This is a remarkable operation, an IED set versus a D9 armored bulldozer. This operation was on January 7th. The ceasefire is declared on the 16th. In the bottom right corner, you're seeing a D9 armored bulldozer pass a Merkava tank. And he's going to hit, we're going to see this from two different angles, but he's going to hit a massive IED. And these are the kind of IEDs that the Israeli military were talking about that they believe. And I think if you look at these, the way that that explosion took place, that these are Israeli munitions being returned to sender. They look very similar to the airstrikes that we watched in shock. Can we show it one more time? That we watched in shock throughout these past 15 months. You can see the armored bulldozer. It's detonated right in front of him. We're going to see it from two different camera. We saw it from the two different camera angles. And the fighters are inside. You can see there, the fighters are watching on the camera there, and they are very excited and shocked even by the massive explosion that was. So this is an area that's supposed to be defeated and is now in the last days of the war, showing a side of the battle that Israel can't handle. If you look at the slide next, yeah, so this looks like an unexploded Israeli bomb. It looks like a return to sender operation, and that matches IDF testimonies. But there's multiple ways that the unexploded ordnance are used. They get rewired and the actual bomb itself is detonated, but they also get harvested, which means you take out the explosive material, which makes up about little less than 50% of the total weight of the bomb. So there's 250, 500 pound, 1,000, 2,000 pound bombs, and the explosive material is 45% weight of those. And then that harvested material can be put into a barrel. They can be put into a shawad. That's obviously not a shawad. That is either a barrel bomb or a reused Israeli missile itself, Israeli bomb itself. So remarkable operation there. And Israel announced this week that that the Trump administration is giving 130 armored bulldozers to replace those ones that we've been watching get blown up, especially in the north in the last couple of months. So the Trump administration opened up that shipment, probably part of the ceasefire agreement that the quid pro quo that Netanyahu was talking about. Let's look at number 12. This is also a significant operation. This is a booby trap operation. We have Israeli soldiers. You can see there's at least a dozen of them there. They're taken out to match community guidelines for YouTube, but they're hit by a devastating explosion, and we're seeing it from a second camera. I edited these guys out, but this was an operation that the Israelis admitted killed four Nahal Brigade, four soldiers from the Nahal Brigade Deputy Commander's Recon Force. Eight others were seriously wounded. So a remarkable operation as well there. And there was half a dozen of those in the Ambushes of Death. Number 13, you'll see the unexploded ordnance that I was talking about. This looks like a 250 pound Israeli bomb, Israeli-American bomb. They wire it in the road without moving it. Here we're seeing a D-9 armored bulldozer pushing over it, thinking that it probably has a pressure plate and the bulldozer doesn't weigh enough to trip the pressure plate. And now we see the Merkava tank roll over it and eliminates the camera. Here we're seeing a separate, that's not the targeted vehicle, being towed away. Yeah, you can watch it again. So you see sometimes they take the they'll harvest the explosives out of it, and sometimes they'll rewire it in here. And here you can see, so the bulldozer goes over it, but the bulldozer doesn't weigh enough to trip the plate. Possible that it's also detonated by hand, and the fighters are in the tunnels waiting and then detonating it in the right place. Both of those tactics work, and it destroys the camera. And then that's a separate armored personnel carrier that's being taken away. So another remarkable operation. And I just wanted to give you a still shot here to show you the size of the warhead. That is the smallest one that Israel drops. The 500, 1,000, and 2,000-pound bombs are significantly larger than that. Number 14 is an attack on Israeli excavators. So watch these guys working. They're destroying what's already been destroyed. Unclear what they're even doing. But Qassam is getting up right up close to them and hitting them with the Yassin strike here from an elevated firing position. You can see that they're Volvo excavators. They didn't even look, the one didn't look armored. And so it's tough to tell. I put a picture, if we go to the next one, there's a still picture here. The fighter that talks about it, the fighter comes and he speaks in plural about the operation. The fighter says, after targeting the excavators, they were completely destroyed and the drivers burned inside them. It's unclear from the video if it's a plural, if both of them have been wiped out. They're just twisted pieces of metal. And Israel may have reclaimed part of the tracks of the vehicle to try to to not leave trophies, which is what Israel does, because there's lots of trophies. Number 16 is another excavator operation. The beginning of this operation, you can see a D9 armored bulldozer clearing the path for the excavator to come in. I've edited this again, but what we're seeing here is the crew of the excavator exiting the vehicle, and it gets hit by Qassam by another Yassin strike that destroys the excavator and the crew. We're seeing here dozens of Israeli soldiers being killed, more than the 20 that they acknowledged in the final days. Number 17 shows this is an RPG operation, an ambush, and it gives a good shot here of how the teams work. You can see there's two archers, and then you have an armor, a man carrying the additional warheads. Those are 85-millimeter anti-personnel and anti-tank warheads that are going to ambush an Israeli position. You can see the green-painted one. I'm going to suggest that that's a newly made weapon. As I pointed out in a number of other videos, that appears that these weapons are being manufactured as the war goes on. So again, appropriate weapons being used, deadly operations. But also this next slide is Qassam's sense of humor here. They put this clip in here of two D9 armored bulldozers driving in what Israel calls devastated terrain, the remnants of people's lives, and it just drops into a hole there. And you can see the exhaust fumes out the back as he realizes that he's been dropped into a hole. So Qassam mocking, if you look at the next slide, it's just a still of it. Qassam just mocking at this point, 15, 16 months into the war, the final days of the battle, and Qassam is devastating the Israeli military. And this is the testimonies after I've showed you those videos from the soldiers. I read you this the other day, but now that we've seen the videos, it hits even harder. This is from Channel 12, who did an in-bed with Israeli soldiers. And this is what he said that the soldiers told them. Testimonies from soldiers from Beit Hanun in northern Gaza said that we are fighting in an environment monitored by cameras by the militants. They have planted explosive devices in every alley and are activating them from inside the tunnels. Their underground tunnel network is fully operational. We cannot see them with the naked eye. For a week and a half, there was no direct identification of any militants. They have completely planted Beit Hanun with huge amounts of explosive devices and remnants of Air Force bombs. Every alley, every intersection is filled with state-of-the-art cameras, 360-degree thermal cameras. They choose their targets carefully. They monitor our movements through their cameras. If there is a drone, they do not activate the bombs. But if there is a military force with command leadership, they activate on top of the command leadership in the convoy. So, i.e., they're able to pick who the commanders are in a convoy of vehicles. That's what he's saying. Back to the quote, they activate explosive devices as soon as the arrival of the rescue teams is announced and they go out and shoot at those forces. That's the one thing that's not true. And we know that throughout the whole war. Qassam targets the rescue operations. That's the tanks that get sent in to get the guys. But they don't attack the medical teams. And we're going to see that in this next video, because this is the coup de grace of the Gaza war. This operation number 19, shown from these cameras that Qassam has everywhere, like the IDF said, we're watching a state-of-the-art Merkava tank. This is the pride of Israel's military industries, moving in front of a camera, a CCTV camera. We blurred out the logo, but the date is the 8th of January, so 8 days before Israel declared the ceasefire. And you're going to watch him back here, back in over again, another massive IED, and maybe the biggest IED of the war. Israel was immediately talking about that being the case, that this was the biggest of the war. That camera doesn't catch the full height of the explosion. But this video is remarkable. This video was shown first on Al Jazeera during the documentary on Friday. But what we're looking at there is you're looking at the upside down hull of the Merkava tank. And on the right hand side, left hand of the screen, top in the upper right corner of the screen, that's the turret. The pressure of the explosion popped the turret off. It's called a turret toss. It explodes. The pressure inside the compartment of the tank has nowhere to go, so it blows out the weakest point. And the weakest point is the turret ring, which we've seen Qassam use guerrilla action devices to hit that turret ring. The turret ring is the weakest, and it blows the entire top turret off. And the turret is where the commander, the gunner, and the loader are stationed. And here you see they don't target medical crews. This is well within range of Qassam weaponry, and Qassam is not targeting medical workers, not on day one of the war and not on this, the last days of the war, the last spectacular operation. You can see on the video, I edited it out to match community guidelines on YouTube, but you can see the stretchers being taken in both the hull and in the turret. And Israel admitted 3 dead and 3 seriously injured. Hard to imagine 3 seriously injured in that explosion. I think this is one of those times where the Israeli military is undercounting. If we look at 19, you can see the still image of it there. So in the upper right, that's the turret upside down on its separated from the hull of the tank. So this is a remarkable picture, a symbolic picture of Israel's defeat in Gaza, the graveyard of the invaders that Qassam promised on day one. And this is the, the chariot of God, the Merkava tank that Israel is the pride of military industries for Israel. So just very remarkable operations, the ambushes of death, the series. There was 2 parts to that series that were released this week, and those are the videos from it. So that is remarkable. And again, this week, there was also another remarkable story. Al Jazeera published a documentary. Again, I'm reporting on the 30th of January. The Qassam footage was released by Al Jazeera on Friday, the 24th. It was a documentary on the program, What is Hidden is Greater. And it was a remarkable documentary. If we look at the maps here, we're going to just show you where we're talking about here. Map 20A is the full Gaza map to give you a sense of what we've been talking about up until now. In the north, Beit Hanun, in the far northeast is where we just covered, and going all the way down to the far southwest, that's Tell al-Sultan. in Rafah. You can see in the zoom in there, Tel HaSultan touches on the Philadelphia corridor. This was the other strategic corridor that Netanyahu, when he realized he wasn't going to defeat Qassam, he was going to hold this corridor and block people's access to it. But under the prisoner exchange deal, after today's exchange, the Rafah crossing is supposed to open, and it will open for wounded patients and allow 50 wounded fighters on top of the civilians to exit through Rafah for much needed, desperately needed medical attention that has been denied since May 7th when Israel sealed off the Philadelphia corridor and took the Rafah crossing. So this is the remarkable footage, number 21, that I brought for you from this documentary. We're going to watch Qassam's top leader, Yahya Sinwar. Here he is covered in a blanket, walking through the devastation of Tel HaSultan. He's walking up here to meet with the commander of the Tel HaSultan battalion, where you can see just the utter devastation. But here you see, in a tactical vest, Yahya Sinwar, who Israel said was in a tunnel surrounded by captives, which all the captives have said is not true. He visited them on the first day, asked if they were well, said they would be taken care of, and said they would be, the civilians would be returned home the next day. He told them that in Hebrew, which he learned in prison, where he was the prison leader as well. He's also, you can see there, that is the Israeli military kicking up dust, driving, I don't know, what is that, 100 meters in front of them? That's Mahmoud Hamdan, the Tel HaSultan battalion commander for the Qassam brigades. And Sinwar is on the front lines here, looking at battle plans. And that was something that when he was killed, we wondered immediately, does that mean there's going to be footage of Sinwar actually commanding operations? And this is the answer to it. Qassam released this footage to Al Jazeera. It was shown on Friday in the documentary on the program, What is Hidden is Greater. There you see him on the front lines. That school is an Israeli military position. He is 125 meters away from the Israeli position along the border. So just really remarkable footage of a commander on the front lines. A couple of things that Sinwar said when he was released from prison in the Gilad Shalit exchange in 2011, he said, they thought prison was our graveyard, but it was our academy. And he also said when he got back into Gaza and put his feet on the ground in Gaza, he said, I will take my place among the fighters of the Qassam brigades. So mission accomplished. He also once jokingly said to a TV interview, he said, I don't like wearing this suit. They forced it on me. I prefer to wear a tactical vest. So he did that as well. So remarkable footage. And then 21B, this is what he said. This is the poem that Nora was talking about. The direct literal translation in English doesn't work too well. It's a beautiful poem by Ahmed Shawki, who is the Prince of Poets, Egyptian poet laureate, some people say founder of modern Arabic poetry. And Sinwar is quoting this line as he walks up to the camera. And I've done a tafsir, not a direct translation, not a literal translation, but in essence, what he's saying in this quote is, in front of true victory stands a closed door, pushed a little more open by every hand bloodied in the struggle for freedom. And that is the line that he walks up. Sinwar's got the poem in his head. You know, Sinwar was an avid reader. All the Israeli intelligence talked about how he just devoured all books when he was in prison, led the library, taught the prisoners. And so it's just a remarkable moment to see him walk up and give that line. And it's not just the sentiment in the poem. It's difficult to translate poems, especially super beautiful poems, and especially in a language like Arabic that English fails almost at every turn. But it's not just about fighters. It's about the civilians too. And so I think that in essence, that's what he's saying. In front of true victory stands a closed door, pushed a little more open by every hand bloodied in the struggle for freedom. So a remarkable statement from the front lines of the battle in Gaza by the leader of the battle, the strategic leader who was released in a prisoner exchange, as we're watching prisoner exchanges happen right now. If we look at 21C, you can see him here with Mahmoud Hamdan. He also had, Sinwar also had with him the Glock that was captured from the Israelis in the critical 2018 counterintelligence. The Qassam foiled a clandestine operation by the Israelis that sent in special forces to try to tap the tunnel telephone line that we've seen be used all throughout this war as mission critical for the reason that Qassam is able to operate for these 16 months. The reason why they have had command and control for these 16 months is because of the tunnel telephone network. Israel in 2018 tried to come in and tap it, and they were caught. They were outed by Qassam security and interrogated, and their gun was captured, and there was a shootout. Several people were killed, and one of the Israelis was killed, and his gun was taken. So Sinwar was holding the gun when he was killed of the Israeli Special Forces soldier who, as part of the 2018 raid. So very, very symbolic, very notable fact that they have captured weapons and they're showing them and using those captured weapons. And this is, like I said, this is Mahmoud Hamdan, Tala Sultan battalion commander. And I'll show you something about him in a moment. But first, let's look at 22D, which is just showing Sinwar right on the front lines. He's in his tactical vest. He's got his captured weapon, and he's commanding operations. He's not in a tunnel. He's not hiding. He's out in front. And so all those suggestions by the Israelis in their architecture of lies that has been underpinning this entire war, this was remarkable footage to see. And if we look at the next one, this is where the Israelis boast of having assassinated Mahmoud Hamdan when they do these eliminated posters. And these are almost always have been absurd. These posters, we saw the one I showed you last week on the show for Abu Hamza Hassan Fayyad in Beit Hanun, the Beit Hanun battalion commander who was not killed. But some of them have been ridiculous. Like they used one photo and said that they eliminated a senior Qassam commander. And the photo was of a famous Egyptian journalist who's like the head of the Egyptian journalist syndicate, who's well known in Egypt. And that was a mockery of the Israeli military's architecture of lies right from the first moments of October 7th, justifying their successes, framing their failures as some kind of subhuman brutality in order to justify the genocide that this week, more than any other week of this war, was proven to be a failure. From the prisoner exchange, the terms of the prisoner exchange are the terms that Qassam demanded. The end of the aggression, the withdrawal from the corridors, the return to the north, those were the key demands by Qassam throughout the negotiations that they refused to give in on. Israel's key demands or key objectives of the war were to return the captives through violence. That failed. Destroy Qassam. That failed. Destroy the government. We saw that today and the last several days that the government is functioning in Gaza. And that number four for Israel was that Gaza was no longer a threat to them after total defeat of Hamas. And Netanyahu even went further and said the idea of Hamas would be defeated for generations to come. Nothing could be further from the truth. We saw this week Palestinians in victory returning home to the north where they will rebuild, and the failure of every single military objective of the Israelis. So that is the resistance report for this week, a monumental week after an incredible 482 days that we've been watching this battle.
Thank you so much, John. And as you said at the very beginning, you know, the news keeps happening. Well, we've been on air. The prisoner exchange has continued. Let's talk a little bit about who some of the Palestinian political prisoners are that are being released, including Zakaria Zubeidi.
Was he released today?
That's what I heard.
Yeah, he was pulled out of the first. He was supposed to be released in the first release, and they pulled him out. Zachariah Zebedee is a leader from the Jenin camp. I worked in Jenin, and I worked around those fighters for many months and watched them in battle. And he is a significant leader. And then he was imprisoned in Joboa prison, and he was part of the tunnel prisoner escape. A bunch of guys from Jenin, Muhammad Al Arda was part of that.
He was also released.
He was released
last week, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're getting their people back. That is what's happening in these prisoner exchanges. They're getting operations leader. The most significant operations leaders are being exiled. Some are being exiled to Gaza in this next upcoming rounds. They'll be sent to Gaza, but many of them are being exiled abroad, which is criminal, I think. Forced exile shouldn't be is against international law, for whatever international law is at this point in the war, but they shouldn't be being exiled, but they are. And Iyad Jaradat is also part of the tunnel, the prison tunnel. So Joboa prison is just the prison that Jenin prisoners would go to. It was actually in the area just up in the hills from where Izzeddin al-Qassam himself was killed in 1935. So there's lots of history. The soldiers that went out, the police at that time, they were called the Palestine Police, but they're soldiers, paramilitaries, that went out. They left from Joboa prison base to go and kill Izzeddin al-Qassam and his band of fighters, which ultimately in 1935 led a few months later to the beginning of the Great Arab Revolt of 1936, which is what we should call the First Intifada. We call the First Intifada in 1987, but the Great Arab Revolt was a spectacular intifada of that time. So Joboa prison is significant. And then these guys are significant because they used a spoon, famously, to dig out and get down into the plumbing area of the prison and then dig out and come out through a manhole. And there was a picture when they broke out of the prison. I think it was in 2021 they broke out. My timelines are weird.
September 21.
And so there's a picture, an amazing picture. I don't know if tomorrow we'll have time, but I'm just throwing it right now. I didn't know we were going to talk about this, but there's a picture of Israeli Shabak officers looking down at the hole that they came out of. They're all circled around the hole, and they can't believe it, that they came out of the hole. And these prisoners, Zachariah Zubaydah is a Fatah al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade prisoner. Muhammad al-Arda, he is a Saray al-Quds, and Jaradat is Saray al-Quds. So it was this like joint operation, right? It's like the joint operations room functioning inside the prison as well. And they got out, and they got out to see their families. They were ultimately rearrested. And when they were rearrested, Jaradat said, don't worry. He said to his guards in his prison, when he was in his trial, to his prison guards, he said, don't worry, Qassam's going to get me out. And they bagged him up and pushed him out of the room after he said that. And here we are today.
There it is.
They just can't believe it. So that is the spoon. It got famous. It got described as the spoon operation, because they used it's probably like more like a ladle. They used a ladle from their soup to do it. And they did it over the course of a number of years to dig through. And this is actually a success of the prisons. This is a success of the prison movements, because continual hunger strikes in the prisons got better conditions for Palestinians, security prisoners in these prisons. So ultimately what it has led to at this time is that the prisoners are actually all in communal space. Ali was talking about his time being isolated. And once you can have the prisoners in communal space, that's where you can talk resistance. That's when you can talk theory. That's when you can teach history. And that's when you can come up with plans like this. They can cover for each other because they have 13, 14, 18 people in an area. Someone can be a lookout for the guard and they can send a signal when the guard's coming and the person with the spoon can stop digging. So this is a multi-layered success, this tunnel escape. And it's a success both of the Palestinian resistance, the hunger strikes inside the prisons, and the fact that the resistance on the outside of the prisons is always trying to free the people inside the prison. Yeah, there's another one of them. Look at, he's just stroking his beard. Like, how did this happen? And it's remarkable. And the fighters were fighters once they got out too. They evaded capture through the hills, just like Izzedine Al-Qassam did, the very same hills, evaded capture and made it back to the Jenin refugee camp. And the last three of them were captured in the Jenin refugee camp where they went to see their families. Remarkable story. So they're being freed today. Zakaria Zubaydi is a hero from the 2002 Battle of Jenin. And so I think in an upcoming show, what we'll do is we'll itemize and tell everybody who the prisoners that are being released are. I haven't really had a chance to do that because there's been so much else to cover, but we should give attention to who was released, because giving attention to who was released in the Shalit exchange would have gotten a bio of Yahya Sinwar.
That's right.
We know the impact that he has made.
Well, that was extraordinary, John, a truly extraordinary report. One thing I'll say about my time, again, not to compare it with Gilboa prison, but the Swiss prison guards were very careful about getting the plastic spoons back with the meal trays. You couldn't keep the spoons.
Yeah.
But I don't plastic think you could spoons. Have dug plastic spoons, and I don't think you could have dug out of there with them either. But they said,
I don't think we can tell you on air with YouTube community guidelines what you can do with the spoons.
Well, yeah, I don't know, but they say we do need the spoon.
Yeah, it's remarkable. The Gilboa prison break is just, there's so many layers to it. The history, the fact that it's a product of prison resistance itself. In North America and in other places in the world, prison is a place where you send someone to send them away from the political movement. It's the way to isolate them. In Palestine, it's the pillar of the movement. And on the inside is all the people who are prepared to return to struggle. So the onus is on people on the outside. And that's why Yahya Sinwar said that all the time. The onus on the people on the outside to get the people on the inside free. That is an obligation of the Palestinian national movement. And this is the success of October 7th that we're seeing. And it's only just beginning. We're only at the third release of the civilian and women soldiers. There is a second phase of this deal where there are presumably many higher at least ranking soldiers, Israeli soldiers, who will require a toll that according to Qassam is going to empty the prisons. That was the goal of the October 7th operation, was to empty the prisons. At this point, we're doing 50-1 life sentences and long sentences for each soldier. But I think you can expect it will be higher for the male soldiers and the commanders of those bases that were overrun.
And of course, that's in the second and third phases of the ceasefire deal, which will only happen if Israel continues to abide by the terms. Of course, there's always this, as you called it, during the Lebanon ceasefire, the uneven ceasefire, right? Like Israel still gets to snipe and kill Palestinians. I mean, just in the past week, there's something like 80 Palestinians, I think, have been killed in Gaza after the ceasefire. But, you know, the the second and third phases still have yet to happen.
Yeah, so I was just pulling out the timeline. The negotiations for phase two begin February 3rd, so they should begin next week, and that will be a significant negotiation.
And it will be one that Israel tries to sabotage and draw out. But I mean, we'll have to wait and see what happens. But I remain hopeful that it will go as planned, because we continue to see, despite these very bizarre statements from Donald Trump about moving Palestinians out of Gaza. And I can't remember if had he already made those statements on Tuesday? I think we talked about them.
Yeah.
That people are not going to be leaving Gaza after they've survived this genocide, they've returned to the North Victorias. They're not going to voluntarily leave to Jordan or Egypt. And who is going to force them if everything Israel didn't force them? But I think that despite those rather erratic statements from Donald Trump, we're still seeing Steve Witkoff, his envoy, basically acting as an enforcer of this deal. And I think the big picture remains that, in a sense, Israel has lost its deterrent against Gaza, because the thing it held over Gaza was this idea that I think everyone believed at some level that if Israel wanted to put in the effort to topple Hamas and take over Gaza, they could, even if it would be very, very costly. That's, of course, at the very beginning, John was saying and others were saying that they're not going to succeed. I get that. But at the same time, nobody knew for sure at that point. Nobody knew for sure. And remember, we were talking about flooding tunnels and putting gas into tunnels and all sorts of things, because nobody was quite sure what the Israelis could do or what the resistance could withstand. Now we're sure they can't do it. And the show of military force and discipline that the resistance is still able to put on is clear. So Israel doesn't really have a deterrent anymore against Gaza. They don't have the leverage they have is the leverage they've always had, which is to try to block aid, to try to make the population suffer. But there too, the population have withstood the absolute worst that human beings can do to one another. They're still suffering from it. We shouldn't think this is over by any stretch. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying that Israel is not, I think it was John who said this, you don't dismantle the Netzarim corridor if you're planning to just restart the war.
Right.
And so I'm still hopeful that this is going to keep unfolding. And Donald Trump has invited Netanyahu to the White House next week, I think, to discuss peace in the region or whatever. But that could just as well, maybe this is me being optimistic, that could just as well be him summoning Netanyahu to tell him, look, don't mess this up and you do what I say. And if you want us to, you know, there's in a sense, and again, people can tell me if I'm being way too optimistic here, but it's sort of a reverse Biden, because this is a hypothesis. I'll say this is a hypothesis. With the Biden administration, you had fake criticism of Israel. Oh, they should be more careful about bombing civilians, and we're going to delay the 2,000-pound bombs for 5 minutes, and we really care about getting humanitarian aid in. We're going to surge humanitarian aid in, which they never did. So there was fake criticism and fake criticism for Israel sometimes, and fake sympathy for Palestinians, while behind the scenes it was carte blanche, do what you want, go as hard as you want, kill as many babies as you want, bomb as many hospitals as you want. Whereas with Trump, it's unconditional public love and a little bit more, you know, some quite firm enforcement behind the scenes. That's a hypothesis. I'd like to hear if anyone thinks that holds water. Mm. Maybe it's just me being optimistic.
Well,
but the basis of it and the bottom line is it's because the resistance won on the ground.
Yeah.
And the way that these phases of the deal overlap and the reason why it's a super complicated agreement is because Israel reneges on all of their points of the agreement. And Qassam and Sinwar said it most clearly that the siege, the blockade of the last generation, that is warfare. And the goal is to end the war. And so the siege has to be lifted as part of phase three of this deal. And phase three ties into phase two in order to make it so that there guarantees, because everybody who watches this conflict can imagine that Israel's just trying to get back its soldiers. And the day they get back their soldiers, then they go back and do whatever they want. And that is why each part of this agreement is overlapping with the other, and it weaves together as an effort to get guarantees that these things will happen. So if Israel wants to get back its soldiers, it has to operate in a way that it has not operated before, or they're not going to get their soldiers back. And so if this is something that Israel believes that it has to happen, that has to happen, that they need to get their soldiers back, then they're going to need to go phase two and phase three are linked together. And they have a way to get their soldiers back. And that way is to end the siege. And that will be a historic moment for Palestinians. Again, we're trying not to get ahead of ourselves.
Right.
There was a point where we were trying to not get ahead of ourselves to say there's significant cadre who are about to come out of prison. And we said, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We don't want to be wishful thinking. But they're already talking about senior leadership. Ahmed Sahadat from the PFLP, Marwan Barghouti's name has continually come up in phase two. The numbers themselves, the 50-1 for each soldier, how many soldiers are there? They've already in the first part of the deal talking about getting half of the life sentences out before the actual captured soldiers are exchanged. And the rate for the captured soldiers is going to be high. We remember the Gilad Shalit exchange in 2011 that took 5 years to negotiate after the Palestinian resistance tunneled under the wall and came up and captured a tank gunner whose name everybody knows. It was 1,027 prisoners for a single soldier. So the goal is to empty the prisons. And if they don't empty the prisons, then they're setting themselves up for another October 7th, because the guarantee is that they will free the prisoners. That is the oath of these people as prisoners. That is the oath of Sinwar, who spent from 1988 to 2011 in prison. The oath is that you don't leave them behind. And that should be the oath of the military as well. Leave no man behind. But Israel's in the process of
shoot them in the back.
Yeah, hunt your own soldiers and shoot them down, bomb them from the air, shoot them, you know, bomb them before they even get to Gaza. Then once they're in Gaza, bomb them. Then once they try to come out and find you and surrender, like in Shajaiya, you hunt them down and kill them.
Maybe it's leave no man behind in another sense of the word, in a sort of mafioso sense, as in
if you leave no man alive.
Yeah.
Leave no man alive. But also there's a political dynamic within Israel with this, because with these scenes that we're seeing week after week of the releases, including today, and many of us will have watched the releases that happened today, which I'm sure we'll discuss in next week's program, but the imagery was incredible. They released one Israeli soldier at the ruins of the home of Yahya Sinwar, and again, the imagery, they had the captured Israeli weapons everywhere and all of that. And just an incredible show of force. But at the same time, Israelis are seeing scenes of happiness, of Israeli families being united with their loved ones that they didn't see for 15 months, except on, you know, those very exceptional occasions. And during that first 8-day truce back in November of 2023. And There's a dynamic within Israeli society, I think, or I hope, that's being created where the society is not going to want to go back to war, even if Netanyahu and a few in the leadership want to, for whatever reason, whether for their own personal reasons or political reasons, that train, in a sense, has left the station. At least that may be what the resistance is hoping, that there is such a momentum to this that the Israeli society that's already shattered, already exhausted, already feels defeated, already has went from, if we think back at the beginning, we had it taken down from our YouTube channel, so we can't show it, but they had that song of that genocidal children's song. Remember that video singing that within a year we're going to eliminate Gaza and kill everyone and build our houses and it will all be rainbows and sunshine for us and they will be crying. And none of that happened. And so they went from that sort of genocidal, vengeful euphoria to feeling defeated and feeling defeated for good reason. So I'm just saying that I think and hope the dynamic is towards advancing the Palestinian people to liberation, that this is not a status quo thing. This was a huge shift in the dynamics of this situation, a historic shift.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to continue to see. I mean, we keep hearing talk of there being a plot for Netanyahu wanting to restart the war after they've got their prisoners out. And, again, we've talked about this before, how even some people on our own side are understandably skeptical about the ceasefire and about Israel keeping to it, because Israel's got a history of breaking ceasefires. But, for these reasons that you're describing, Ali, I mean, and the phases that John has described, I mean, I think we are going to continue to see this. And it's going to be hard for them to go back to war for these political reasons, as well as the military reasons and the sort of, the reality is, as we've covered, and I wrote an article about this a few months ago, that really, the Israeli military was really on the verge of collapse. The Israeli army was on the verge of collapse for months. And there's increasing signs of stress in Israeli society and lack of willingness to go back to war. Lack of the will to do it. And as well, because of the phases of the release of the ceasefire and of the prisoner exchanges, thank you, Tamara. That's the article that I wrote that I'm referring to. Because of the secrecy within the Israeli media and with it, imposed by military censorship of the identity of the Israeli prisoners of war that are still in Gaza, the military prisoners of war, we don't know who they are. We don't know who all of those men, mostly men, are. And we don't know their ranks. There was talk and some reports very early on, I think or probably on the day itself of the October the 7th, 2023, of a very, very high level Israeli military officer being captured. Now, we have not really heard anything about that since then. So the sort of 50-1 exchange, some of the, in terms of 50 Palestinian political prisoners released for Israeli prisoners of war, military prisoners of war, it may be even higher than that in some cases. We just don't know. So it's going to be something that obviously we're going to have to continue to cover very closely.
Yeah, it's going to be way higher than that. That was the civilian, in the civilian release part, that those numbers were from. But yeah, Asaf Hamami, who is the Gaza Division Southern Brigade Commander, is known to be captured. that's a senior figure. That's the kind of figure that is going to release an Ahmed Sadat or a Marwan Barghouti or an Abdullah Barghouti from Qassam. Israel is saying they're not going to release Abdullah Barghouti, who's an operations, like an engineer, a bomb maker that Israel doesn't want to release. But the political figures like Sadat and Barghouti that's the rank. They're going to want people of senior ranks. And we don't fully know who was in those bases, dead or captured. And that has been kept under wraps by Israel pretty tightly through the military censor. So there's a lot more to be known. But the 50-1 was the humanitarian. The number will be much, much, much higher for the soldiers.
So the second phase is supposed to begin next week, February 3rd. They start negotiating. Okay. And then when is there's no date yet set for the implementation of phase two?
Phase one is 42 days. Mm-hmm. And that ends March 2nd. Okay. So the phases are each Saturday, they will release three more soldiers starting on February until March 2nd. And then phase one can be extended. So Phase one, if they don't, they start negotiations on February 3rd for phase two. If those negotiations that start on February 3rd for phase two don't resolve before the end of the 42 days, which would be 1 month later, if it takes more than a month, the 42-day stage continues. It doesn't immediately revert back to war. This is part of the way that they've weaved everything into each other. So that 42 days of stage one would be extended. And that's, okay. I think that, I don't want to make predictions, but that is one that I think we could see be delayed, because the stage two negotiations are very, very significant. The number of soldiers, the number of to be released, but also the structure of the reconstruction of Gaza, how that is going to work, and the end of the siege is all tied into that. Those are very fraught negotiations that could carry on. I think it's reasonable to think that it's possible for it to carry on for months.
I mean, I remember our contributor, Asim al-Nabi, who's the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, he reiterated this this past week. You know, the United Nations and in other international aid agencies are saying that there are 50 million tons of rubble by their estimates. And it would take, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20 years to clear and rebuild Gaza. But as Asim said, and he said this about a year ago, but again, just reiterated that this week, that's under the you know, using the guidelines of how many trucks have been allowed into Gaza, and including the trucks that are filled with reconstruction materials that Israel has prohibited over the last 17 years of this siege, of course. So yes, you know, if the siege continues, and if the proper equipment isn't let into Gaza, sure, it could take 10 to 20 years. But Palestinian engineers have crunched the numbers. And if the siege is lifted and if the proper materials are let in, Asim says that it would take about a year to not just clear the rubble, but rebuild significant portions of Gaza. And so that also, I think, is really important for those of us in the West who are reading these reports, who are, you know, kind of becoming very frustrated with, oh my God, you know, 50 million tons of rubble and the UN estimates 10 to 20 years, that Palestinians already know how to do this, that there is already plans in place by the top engineers in their field in Gaza, who have plans, who have, you know, blueprints of how to carry this out. And it just, it depends on the West, and it depends on on this siege, this barbaric siege of almost two decades being lifted?
Well, the way that Qassam has negotiated and Hamas has negotiated, the soldiers should not be returned if there is going to be a blockade. So that is the way that this has been structured all along. And that's why it's been considered by Israel to be a difficult negotiation.
Right.
And William Burns, the CIA director, former director, who's the back channeler, he said it was the most complicated negotiation that he's carried out in his life, because Hamas refuses to give in on the core tenets of the deal. They'll give you a little bit of flexibility around the margins, like they'll let an American company come in and do the security checks, if that, you know, makes it so that Israel will move to the next stage. They sent impotent forces who can't do anything, which is interesting in the post 9/11 world, that they're sending special operations, ex-special operations mercenary companies to search cars of Qassam fighters, but not be able to arrest them. Is like, doesn't look like a win, maybe, if you just look at it in the Washington Post story, but it's a significant development and the success of these negotiations.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, well, there is always so much to cover. We'll have so much more to talk about next week, but let's leave it right there for now. I want to talk about the website. We've published these extraordinary features. I quoted from one by Rasha Abu Jalal up there at the top. Just extraordinary features as people are returning to their homes in both the north and the south of Gaza, trying to plan for what's next. Absolutely stunning features that we've published over the last week. So please go check that out. We also have incredible analysis by our staff editors. There's Dave Cronin's blog up at the very top there, about the EU rewarding Israel for genocide by approving a new drone deal. So please go read that extraordinarily important analysis by Dave. Also, we have media analysis and critique by Michael F. Brown. Of course, Ali, we have those two statements that we, the staff, published.
I was the news. I was the news for a few days. And
right.
Let me just say about that, that I'm still going through the so many messages I received by text, by WhatsApp, by email. I haven't even started going through my email. I have more than 1,600 emails I haven't gone through yet. through Twitter DM, and the support and solidarity and love, not just for me personally, but for all of us at EI, for what we do, is just so humbling and extraordinary. And I can't tell you how grateful I am. And and remember that we're still here. We've never not been here. And even if attention starts to drift in the mainstream media or other places, we are going to be here, and we're going to keep the focus on Gaza, on Palestine, on the struggle that is going on. And we are going to continue working with our colleagues in Gaza, supporting them. We still need them to tell us what's going on and to keep doing the extraordinary reporting they're doing. And we still need to work with them and support them, and we're going to be here for the long haul. So I just want to say again, thank you to everyone for your sustained support of the work we do. And if you want to continue to do that, this is a great time. It's always a good time to sign up to give a monthly donation of any amount that you can afford, by going to electronicintifada.net, and you can click donate now, or you can, if you're watching on YouTube, there's a link in the description. But the point is, if you can, if you want to be part of this for the long haul, that's a great way to do it. And as always, give what you can. Don't give if it's going to cause you or your family or someone who depends on you hardship. We've said, and yeah.
We did have a few people actually write to us while you were inside, Ali, said they'd made donations because, you know, as a way to stick it to the Swiss, I guess.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. That means a great deal to me. And our goal is just to keep doing this work and make it available for everyone everywhere. And it's incredible that our audience is growing all over the world. And we can also thank the Swiss for that, because a lot more people became aware of us over the last few days. What did they call that? The Streisand effect. They wanted to silence us, and they ended up giving us a far bigger platform. And we want to use it to keep doing this work. And remember the discussion we just had with Abid Ayyub of ADC at the beginning of this this live stream, the importance of knowing your rights, being wise in terms of what you can and can't do, given whatever position you're in, but don't back down, continue to speak out, be in solidarity with one another. And we have to continue to do this. We are not, I am certainly not going to give up. And I don't think any of us are. And that's the message I want to make loud and clear, especially after the last week or so.
Thank you so
much. If you want to know more about what Ali's ordeal and what he went through, go back and listen, watch this really good we had a special live stream about it over the on Tuesday, it was right, everything's happening really quickly, and Nora did a really good a really good exclusive global exclusive interview with Ali.
haven't done any other interviews. I've been asked, and I just haven't really had the wherewithal, and I feel like tell the story once from beginning to end, and we did it here on the Electronic Intifada live stream. So you'll find that on the YouTube channel and on the website. And the one small update I can give is that this is not over. There are fantastic lawyers in Switzerland who are right now working on a number of legal counterattacks, let's say, to what happened on a number of aspects. And I don't want to get into that in detail because I don't want to say something incorrect, but when we can, I will. But I just want people to know we are definitely going to be fighting back legally as well.
So many things to possibly look forward to. Thank you for that, Ali. And I know that we're all very, again, we're very relieved and happy that you're out of prison and, you know, relatively unharmed. We're happy to see you back here in the chair. So with that, I just want to thank Tamara Nassar, of course, for directing and producing this live stream, for Maureen Claire Murphy, senior editor, for help with pre-production, Michael F. Brown for fact-checking, Ellie Gerzon for social media. On behalf of all of us, myself, Ali, Asa, John, and Tamara, thank you all for watching and listening. Thanks to everyone at the Electronic Intifada, and we will see you next week. Thank you.